Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, Red Sneaker Writers. Welcome to the November 16, 2020 episode of the podcast. Well, as you can probably tell just by listening, we've got power again. So I'm back in the studio. The ice storm is over. We're out of the dark ages. And glad to be there. We have ice cream again. We did lose two magnificent trees, and that makes me sad. If nothing else, the whole experience reminded me how much we take advantage, like all this technology that allows me to write on a laptop that weighs less than 2 pounds and take it anywhere and record these podcasts that go out all over the world. And probably it's not such a bad thing to have a little reality check like that every now and again, but I miss the trees. My interview this episode will be with J.A. Ludwig, the author of the high fantasy series Blood Magic. The first book, which just came out recently, is called Bloodfall Arena, and people are comparing it to The Hunger Games and Game of Thrones. Anything games, apparently, in the fantasy world. I'm kidding. It's a terrific novel, really, really fine. So I wanted to talk to her about the first author experience and how this book came about. There will also be some writing tips later in the podcast, but first, the news. All kinds of things are happening in the publishing world these days. Perhaps one of the things that will most directly impact Red Sneaker Writers is the announcement from Amazon that they are now allowing authors or their publishers to have direct input on the series page. Now, just to be clear what I'm talking about, some of you who write or read series books, books in a series like my Daniel Pike series. 5 books so far, going to be 6. Fifth one just came out, Judge and Jury. But if you go on Amazon, you can find a page dedicated to that series. Well, those have always existed, assuming the authors or publishers identified the books as being in a series. But now they're allowing people to have input to help shape what that page looks like, which has caused all kinds of confusion and controversy. And how do I label my series? Is it, you know, the Daniel Pike legal thriller series, or would my interview guest's series be the Blood Magic High Fantasy series, or is Epic Fantasy or better? What do I go with? And then you're supposed to come up with a brief description of the series, which I think is brilliant. You know, give me a sentence or two to explain to people exactly what this is so they know whether they're interested. You can even dictate how the page looks and set up sort of a carousel ad type thing. If you don't give them any input, they'll assume you want the first book in the series to be most prominent, but you can change that. So there's a lot of opportunity here that I want to urge Red Sneaker Writers to take advantage of. Too often, I think writers make the mistake when they're posting on Facebook or whatnot of highlighting the page where the book is selling, that particular book, when they copy a link and paste it into their social media posts. But it might be more advantageous to link people to the series page where they can see all the books. And if you're going to be linking to the series page, then it makes sense to make it look the way you want it to. In other news relating to Amazon, because ACX is Amazon's subsidiary, which gives authors the opportunity to record and produce audiobooks, ACX sent a note out, an email, to its participants just a few days ago as I record it. You've heard me complain on previous podcasts about how slow the ACX and Audible approval rate has been. That's why it took so long for Dazzling Description to show up for sale. And I'm still waiting for Judge and Jury to show up. Everybody has assumed that this is COVID related because so many people are working at home. But according to this message that ACX's president sent out earlier this week, no, they've been hit with, quote, unprecedented waves of submissions that do not meet our guidelines, end quote. So basically what they're saying is that people are sending them substandard books, and somehow that's slowing down the approval and adding process. I'm not sure why that would be. I mean, they listen to all of them and they say thumbs up and thumbs down, and I'm not sure that one takes more than the other. Are they saying that because people are submitting multiple times that take, I really can't tell from the letter what it is they're going for, but at least they are acknowledging that they are way behind. And that might be something for the Red Sneaker writer to consider, too. There are other ways of having audiobooks distributed. Find Away Voices being one that I've mentioned before. Advantageous, particularly if you're using draft to digital, because the two work well together. And they can't force, you know, Findaway can't force Audible Books to add the book to their platform, but they can send it everywhere else, and at least that would be a workaround ACX that, for whatever reason, seems to be having troubles. Other publishing news. We've talked about how the Big Five may be diminishing. Several publishing houses are for sale, though not being sold, and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt is now up for sale as well. To be clear, HMH is not one of the Big Five. However, they are definitely a large publisher, and now they've put their trade or consumer division up for sale. That would be the books sold for the general market, books that you see at the bookstore. What they're holding on to is textbooks, which do very well for them. And this, of course, suggests that textbooks are doing well, but normal, regular, you know, reader trade books, less so. Well, of course, the Big Five are already swarming. Some people are predicting that Simon & Schuster, which is itself up for sale, might be in the play, that somebody might be doing some 3-to-1 purchase or something. Who knows? But there's a lot of flux in traditional publishing right now. And right now, it is just impossible to say how that's going to work out. Of course, there's flux in the world of self-publishing as well. Amazon announced this past week that they are shuttering down the Kindle Owners Lending Library, which you often see identified by the acronym KOLL, K-O-L-L. This is the function that's allowed people to borrow books without actually paying for them. They pay a subscription rate. And then authors are compensated, not according to a sale, because there was no sale, but according to pages accessed, which we've discussed this before. Amazon has some spooky way of knowing whether somebody read the whole book they downloaded or read the first three pages and said, man. And if they don't open it at all, they bought it free or cheap and never opened it, then you wouldn't get paid at all. Well, this was a dubious business model to me from the beginning, but now it's over. They're shutting it down. No explanation given for why. Speaking of experiments involving Amazon, this one has to do with the UK. But people have detected that some of the Big Five publishers, who normally do not participate in Amazon's Kindle Unlimited service, have been doing so recently, quietly, with major authors and major backlist titles. Just to be clear, KU is the subscription service. It's a platform that if you're self-publishing or publishing somebody else, you can designate the book as being KU or not. If you do, there are a few sales and promotional advantages, but not that many, in my opinion. But it does require you to be exclusive to Amazon, which of course is why the Big Five publishers have avoided it. Until now, it would appear that Pan Macmillan in the UK has given KU titles like from authors like Jeffrey Archer, Winston Graham, major authors. HarperCollins UK has also put some of their backlist titles in. No word on whether this is a long-term or short-term, you know, they're just testing the waters, clearly, and how long they're there are probably dependent on how well it pans out for them. But it would appear that they're trying to use KU to move their backlist. I have also reported in the past that there have been problems, particularly this year, getting books printed. And now I'm talking about the actual physical printing of books on paper, and that the two largest printers in the United States were either shut down or out of business or working half-time or whatever, and for sale. Well, guess who bought one? Bertelsmann, which is, of course, the parent corporation of Penguin Random House, bought two of the book printing operations that a company named Quad, Q-U-A-D, has been trying to sell since at least last year. This makes sense, of course, that the world's largest publisher would want to have their own printer. This is an alignment that makes perfect sense and was probably a real godsend for Quad because and for everybody, since that keeps them printing and in business. One last note, one last bit of sort of kind of news. A new study has been conducted. There have been studies in the past, people trying to determine the benefits of fiction and reading. Does it make you smarter? Does it make you a better person? I would have thought the answer to that was obvious already. But here's a new study. It was reported on by Beth Elwood at a site called SciPost, P-S-Y-P-O-S-T, so you can check it out yourself. Here's the bottom line, as best that I, with not a science degree to my name, am able to convey it. Their researchers have found evidence that literary fiction, as opposed to popular fiction, literary fiction reading is connected to more accurate estimates of other people's opinions. That is, the people who read literary fiction are able to make more perceptive or accurate estimates of others. And popular fiction reading is linked to, quote, increased egocentric bias. Meaning what now? That it makes you more of what you already are? Or if you can read it yourself. You know, I always thought that reading, period, was a good idea. And that, of course, reading any kind of fiction makes you more empathetic and helps you understand other people and the way they think. But these people seem determined to make some kind of distinction between the two, which makes me think, so what are you saying? Since I'm primarily a popular fiction writer, does that mean I'm just writing to egocentric bias, which really doesn't sound good? I have a hard time buying that, but like I said, you can check it out for yourself. To be fair, they did say in this report that they were not suggesting that literary fiction is, quote, inherently better, end quote. They're just saying that they, quote, cultivate different socio-cognitive processes, end quote. My advice, Red Sneaker writers, you go on writing what you like to write, and readers, you go on reading what you like to read. Challenge yourself occasionally. Sure, we all like to try new things. That's how you broaden your perspectives, discover new fields and new writers, but never let anybody make you feel guilty about reading. Just the fact that you read puts you in the upper crust sliver of intelligentsia, and there is never going to be anything wrong with that. In the writing tips section, I wanted to talk a little bit about what you've seen in the news section, not so much this time, but in the past, people's talking about the challenges presented writing characters of different gendered or different race, religion, sexual preference, and sometimes authors being called out because somebody accuses them of cultural appropriation or not knowing what they're talking about or being patronizing to another race, which I think has left some writers kind of skittish about writing about anyone who doesn't look just like themselves, which is not what we want. That's the exact opposite of diversity and inclusion. Anyway, I was triggered. The idea for this section was triggered by an article I read. It was written by a woman named Penny Jolson, and you can find that at We Need Diverse Books. Her point was that people with chronic illnesses are missing from YA fiction, young adult fiction, that YA has become diverse and inclusive, and you'll find all kinds of races and a lot of acceptance of sexual diversity, but not many people with chronic illnesses, which, of course, many young people do suffer from, things like chronic fatigue syndrome. And they might feel more included, might get that warm feeling that you're supposed to get from reading, no matter what kind of fiction you're reading, if there was more of that in the books they were reading. Well, here's what I think. This is very much on my mind right now because I'm working on a new series. As some of you know, the sixth and final of this Daniel Pike set has not come out yet, but I'm already way beyond that. And I've been creating a new cast of characters. And you want to be diverse and inclusive, but not, you know, not just do it for the sake of doing it, not resort to tokenism. I think we've all in recent months seen too many TV shows or whatnot where the gay relationship or the trans character seems tossed in just to be there, but it doesn't really have any inherent relevance to the story being told. I think what you want to do is be inclusive where it's natural to the story you're telling, but make it count. Not just there for the sake of being there, but make it important to the story you're telling, which you can do by shaping the story correctly. This is really no different from what I said many years ago when I wrote Creating Character and Perfecting Plot, that I don't believe that, for instance, literary fiction is character-driven and popular fiction is plot-driven. I think it's all character-driven, but you still need to tell a story. It's just, you know, it's just a question of finding characters that people can relate to and coming up with something that's meaningful. Those two are two sides of the same coin. The character has to fit the plot, and the plot has to fit the character. And if you're putting in a character that doesn't really have anything to do with the plot, it's a mistake. If you want that character, you need to find a way to make it count. I thought, a great example of this yesterday watching Star Trek Discovery. I'm sure some of you, your eyes are already rolling up in your head. You're thinking, oh no, he's a Trekkie. This will go on for 20 minutes. It won't, I promise. But here's what they've done in the series. They've got two new characters this season. And if you've read the publicity, you know that of the actors playing these two characters, one of them is non-binary, the other is trans, and they're in a relationship in the story. I won't go into detail because I don't want to spoil it for people who might not have seen the episode yet, but point is, I thought it was beautiful. I mean, it brought tears to my eyes. I thought it was so beautifully presented. It helps, of course, that this is science fiction, and it's like 1,000 years in the future, and one of them's an alien, so, you know, whatever. But the point is, it wasn't diversity just for the, you know, they could have just tossed somebody on the bridge and never mentioned much about it. But, you know, there's my token trans character. But instead, they made it important to the story. And that's what makes it work. So do your research. You don't want to be accused of not getting your facts right or cultural appropriation. But where appropriate to your story, be open to inclusion, be open to diversity. Just make sure that what you're doing is, in fact, an inherent and important part of the story you're telling. My interview this time is with J.A. Ludwig, somebody I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with for some time. I couldn't have been more excited when her first book, Bloodfall Arena, was published. I think she won't mind too much if I mention I knew her dad, who's also an author as well, and everybody loves to see the generations repeating in such a wonderful way. But focus on J.A. right now, because Bloodfall Arena is a terrific book, and the next book in this series, Blood Embers, will be out early in 2021. Here's what she has to say about becoming an author. Jennifer, thanks for being on the podcast.
Hi, I'm very excited to be here.
Is it all right if I call you Jennifer? I know you're using initials as your book title author, but I just don't think I can sit here talking to you and calling you J.A.
That's fine.
That doesn't seem right. All right. Traditional first question. If you could give an aspiring writer one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think the biggest one that was helpful to me was don't worry about having that first draft be perfect. Just get it out. Because a lot of people don't even, as they're writing the first draft, they start questioning everything. They're like, oh, this isn't good. I shouldn't even bother. But just keep going. Nobody's first draft is perfect. Everybody looks back on their first draft and they're like, who wrote this? This is awful. And then you're like, oh, wait, I wrote it. That's right. So it's all right if it's bad. They're supposed to be bad. You're still figuring things out. And it always gets better.
You're not going to stop at the first draft. It's just a first step, right?
Right. I think I have like 20 versions of Bloodfall Arena, my book, coming out. So I have a lot of drafts of it.
Oh, that explains why it's so good.
Yes, thank you.
How long have you been working on this?
I would say I've been working on it for almost 10 years.
Wow.
It was one that when I first started writing it, it was just something for fun. And I joke because the original drafts aren't even called Bloodfall Arena. They're called 10 Plays because it started actually as I was listening to music. And I know that's something that a lot of people don't like, but it kind of formulated from that. Like the first draft of it is, like I said, awful, full of cliches, not a very through story. But it's because I was listening to music as I wrote it. And the music actually kind of helped me keep writing it a little bit.
You're not the first author I've heard talk about playing music in the background when they write. That would be far too distracting for me. When I hear music, I want to listen to the music.
Yeah. it helps because the music I listen to, it doesn't have words. It's actually the music that really inspired me was actually trailer music that they use in movies. Because they're made to be action forward, or they're made to cause emotions
right.
in people.
Tell people what they're supposed to feel.
Exactly. So it was good in getting like the basic outline out.
No, that makes sense. My son Ralph listens to, film music all the time. Where do you find this trailer music?
I got it on iTunes. There's actually entire bands dedicated just to trailer music, and one of the top ones that everybody's heard but they don't even know they've heard them is Two Steps from Hell. And it sounds like that should be like a rock band, but they're not. They're just they write trailer music, and they've done trailers for the past I think 20-30 years. Like they've been in the business a long time. And they release all the music. They're like, here, have our music, enjoy it.
Okay, so you've been working on this book for 10 years, which I think is an important point to make. Can success as a writer happen? Yes. Will it happen overnight? Probably not. But when did it start to feel to you like, I may actually have something here?
I would say it was probably the first time when I took one of your classes in Hawaii.
Right.
And I brought it in, right. And it was the first time I'd shown anyone.
Right. And that was a retreat in Hawaii. And since you've been on the WriterCon cruise, which yes. Thank goodness we did that when we did, huh?
Yes. It was perfect timing.
I don't think anybody will be cruising again anytime soon, but I could tell when you were there that this thing was ready to rock and roll. When did that first retreat experience help you kind of take the book to the next level? That's what we always hope for.
Yeah. It showed to me that there was something there that I think people who aren't familiar or aren't as much fantasy readers. And I feel like if you can get people who aren't readers of that genre to be interested in that genre, yeah. then that means you're doing something right.
Very good. Well, so I should say this Bloodfall Arena is the first book in a series, the Blood Magic series. And it's a fantasy novel. Did I say that already? With a young female protagonist. You do an enormous amount of world building in this first book. Where'd you get the idea for this world?
I've always liked making kind of fantasy worlds. And I think that actually stemmed from the Lord of the Rings movies. I read the books, but it was hard because he's very good at world building, but it's a lot of words. He's very dense. But when I saw it on the screen, I was like, oh, yes, I like the fantasy worlds don't have to be hard to imagine. They just have to, make not sense, but you pull from what you already know. 'Cause really fantasy worlds are just kind of mirrors of our world, just made more fantastical in a way.
Right.
Like a lot of the places and you'll see this in like Game of Thrones is a great example. It's basically Europe. It's yep. England. It's just taken parts from there.
Maybe 14th, 15th century, something like that.
Yeah. And he pulled a lot from history and he used that in his world building. It's still a fantastical land, but it's like, you can imagine that being real. And
I always felt to me like this is the War of the Roses, except with dragons.
Exactly. Like people think that it's hard to create fantasy worlds. Like it's not as hard as you think. The hardest part I would say is just writing it out. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of, that's not in the book. I have a lot of descriptions that I did as kind of exercises because I figured if I can write them in the story, I should be able to write like an entire, not entire history, but you know, be able to write what I think like a particular part looks like that maybe they're not going to see a lot of.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But you know it, right?
Yeah, but I know it, which makes it feel more real when I just write about it in like one sentence. Like,
have you mentioned the Lord of the Rings films? Have you always been a fantasy reader?
Yes. I think the first adult books I ever read were Stephen King and then fantasy books. And in particular, Mercedes Lackey was a huge.
Oh, I know Misty Friend. She's an Oklahoman too.
Yes. She was a big introduction into fantasy. And that led me to the Lord of the Rings series. But I think her book covers always got me because they were so beautifully, they were beautiful pieces of artwork. And she's had, I think, the same book cover artist her entire career. And it's just like, when you see the covers, you're like, that is a Mercedes Lackey book.
I think you're talking about her husband, Larry, right? I think
yes. He says that. Yes.
You know, I always tell people in retreats and WriterCon and whatnot, write what you love. Is this a case of you writing what you love?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, good. What about the characters? Your protagonist, of course, is a young woman. Oh, am I going to mispronounce her name? How do you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Aya Flandine, but I'm not a stickler if people mispronounce the names because fantasy likes to have some crazy names sometimes. You know?
That's the problem. If it were Karen, I'd know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Aya. Okay, great. How did you come up with her?
I think she started, she actually kind of started not as she is now, obviously, but she started just kind of as an observer. Like she, I wanted her to kind of relate to the reader where she's thrown into something she doesn't understand, which I think is a goal most authors have. Right. But originally she just kind of started as just like, just the eyes. You were part of her and then watching it with her and learning with her. But as I went through a couple more drafts, a couple more edits, I realized, no, she doesn't have to be that. She can be her own being that is more related to a power. Like I really appreciate the female characters that are observers, but then they decide, I don't want to be an observer anymore. I want to have my hand in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think during some of the drafts, I realized like she was starting, especially as I was writing later into the series, she started pulling back a lot more. And it kind of, other characters overtook the story. And I was like, no, I want to keep her in the front.
Right, right. I kind of had the idea reading this and knowing you a little that maybe there was a little bit of you in this character. Am I right about that?
Yes, I just didn't want to say that.
Well, you're being modest, but you know, most people, particularly when they're writing their first book, put more than a little of themselves in the lead character. But I think that works here.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, you want that character to feel real, and the realest person you know is yourself. So, I mean, you kind of have to put a little bit of yourself in them, and you're with them for such a long time when you're writing their story that, I mean, you bleed into them no matter how hard you try not to.
Mm-hmm. This is, as I said, the first book in a series. How much of this series is actually written?
I would say actually the whole series is written. Wow. I still haven't fully committed to whether it's going to be a trilogy or if there'll be four books. It's still kind of.
And that tells me it'll be four books or maybe five, but honestly, I could be wrong.
But they are written right now. It's just kind of, it's after going through the edits, the first like serious edits of the first book, it's
mm-hmm.
I like things kind of materialized that I hadn't even thought about. Cause you know, when you have other eyes on it, they see something in there that you don't, you're like, oh yeah, I actually have been kind of building to that. I just didn't know I was building to that.
Starts so it's real in a hurry when you get editor feedback, huh?
Oh yeah.
Well, so you've been at this a while. You've worked hard, obviously. You've produced a great book, and now it's in print where people can read it and buy it. What are some of the lessons you've learned during this journey to publication?
I think the biggest one was not, like, when people give you criticism, it's coming from a good place. It's not, they're not destroying what you're working on. They want to help you improve it,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that I was always scared of. Like, I think every author is scared of that when they're with their first story, because it's something you've been working on. You don't really want other people to tear it down, and it comes off that way, but it's not what they're doing. They're showing you how it can be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's...
And I would say having a professional editor has been extremely helpful in that as well.
Well, that's the way it's supposed to work. One last thing, and I don't mean to embarrass you, but I just have to mention, since he's also been on the podcast, and I think this is an actual first for the history of the podcast, your father is also a published author, right?
He is, yes.
So has that been a help or a hurt? Which one? I won't tell him what you say.
It's been actually very helpful because you know, it's getting published, getting your story ready is probably a top stressful event. But it helps to have someone who's already gone through it, mm-hmm. and who can help you understand that it's just stressful right now, but like you're gonna love it, you're gonna be so happy when it's done. And also he's been very helpful in just kind of being that supportive voice that was needed.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Jennifer, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again, J.A., for that terrific interview. Let me implore all of you listening to this podcast to take a couple seconds and review the podcast, or if you don't have time for that, just give it a rating at wherever source, wherever you go to download your podcasts. It does not take long, but let me tell you, those 5-star ratings and those great reviews really do increase our searchability, which means you're helping me bring more people to this podcast and helping it continue. And I really appreciate that. I also got to remind you that I'm doing an online 5-day writing workshop in December. I know the website calls it a retreat because they're normally retreats, but when we're not going anywhere, I just can't bring myself to call it a retreat. It's a workshop. We're going to spend 5 days in a small group working together. I'll be reading your manuscripts and editing them and giving you feedback and talking about topics of direct relevance to you and your writing and your career. And if you think that could be of benefit to you, please go to my website, williambernhardt.com, click on Red Sneaker Writers, and sign up while there's still available. Still space available. Until next time, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit.